smoking section.
Here we are, another episode, season 6, smoking section podcast, and I have here Deacon from Nashville, most recently Ward from Outer Banks, but I know him as Charles Esten. How are you, sir?
I'm doing so good. I'm glad to be with you.
I'm glad to see you again. I've seen you more times than I've seen my parents in the last 3 months.
Well, this is the quietest that I've ever seen you. Yeah. Whenever I'm normally seeing you, it's a little bit of mayhem going around in all the right ways.
I don't think it's a little bit. I think it's just completely chaos is what it is.
That is some job you got down there holding that together. It's a rodeo down on Broadway.
Good Lord. I mean, listen, I want to thank you for coming in for doing that, by the way, because
that was
a lot of fun.
Of course, everybody knows what we're talking about.
It's a happy hour
down there with
good old Buzz.
With Buzz, but I got to do it one time without Buzz.
Yeah.
Yeah. And come to find out, he was just dead weight to the whole thing. No. No. I'm saying that to make you laugh. Buzz is the king.
Listen, Buzz. Listen, Buzz.
Honestly, truthfully, I would watch him do that, and then they asked me if I could fill in for a week, and I go, I realized later he just makes it look easy.
It's not easy at all.
It's airliner.
And here's the thing: it's fun, but it's an exhausting fun.
Yeah.
We get really exhausted by
I bet there's a lot of energy and focus, and when you're in and when you're out,
yeah,
what you're leading with, and what comes next,
and if we don't drink,
and it's all super improvisation.
Yes.
Yeah. And you drink.
And we drink. Yeah. So it's if we don't drink, we're screwed.
It is not, it's more than an hour, but it is definitely happy. So I got to get that. That's a happy place down there every week.
Well, my friend, let's talk about this because we're going to get to the music in a minute here, but we got to talk about this Outer Banks ending here.
All right.
Because I just finished it. And my friend.
Spoiler alerts, everybody.
Spoiler alerts. Ward dies. Exactly.
That's pretty cut and dry right there. Yeah, keep going.
And so I was talking to the publicist about this before, but it was like the entire season was a path of redemption for Ward.
I felt that for sure.
And then you just told me, which I don't think many people know, you wrote the ending.
Well, I wouldn't say that so much. I would say that I offered up the suggestion that perhaps Ward's death could happen in a way that was sacrificial for his daughter, because what the writers had laid in there from mm-hmm. the very beginning was the depth of his love for Sarah. That never changed. And it's just one of those things where throughout the show, he says he's doing this for his family. And he was. In many ways, he was. He knew what it was to grow up poor, to grow up a pogue. He was a kook now, and he was not going back, come hell or high water. So he just kept making these bad decisions and then doubling down on them. What I found very interesting was at the end of season 2, you know, on the face of it, he had everything. He had all the gold and he had the cross. Mm-hmm. But he had nothing. He was sort of empty. He had, and he just had his butt kicked by John B. But then John B. spared his life and let him live. But meanwhile, the Pogues, who have nothing, no money, no, literally nothing. They're on an island.
Right.
They have everything. They're as happy as clams. So there was something about starting from that place that I think really resonated with the writers and myself of, all right, you have everything and now it's meaningless. And obviously, that's the thing that people can feel in their own ways. Certain people mm-hmm. reach the success or reach what they want, maybe by less evil means than Lord does, but they find out there's no there. And so they have to reconsider what are the things that are truly important to them. And of course, the cross itself is the whole theme of the cross in real life is redemption. So there was that moment where Ward is looking at this priceless, bejeweled, golden cross. And it moves something in him more than just that that money thing that he's always had. It moves something deeper. He realizes all he's done to get this ill-gotten gold. And especially regarding his daughter. And so he starts talking about a path to redemption, but you know, you're like, there's talking it and then there's walking it.
Right.
So he ends up going back to Outer Banks and trying to get his son, Rafe, to follow along his line. Rafe ain't having it, which is very much how it is. Just because you hit your rock bottom doesn't mean the people you walked it with have hit theirs.
Right.
So I really thought it was all pointing towards that. And I'm very glad we got to do it that way, that it turns out he was not lying. When Sarah said, Sarah says in one of the scenes, you remember he told me you would do anything? And Ward says, anything.
Yep.
And so he did anything.
He did anything. And it's kind of crazy because it's like you talk about how, you know, he had everything in the world that he wanted, but he still didn't have happiness. And that kind of proves that's a life like motto. Like you can be as rich as you want and have all the materialistic shit, but at the end of the day, you know, when you don't have love or your family or whatever.
It's funny you say that. There's a song in Nashville. It's probably the song of Nashville. It's called A Life That's Good. Mm-hmm. And it says, one of the second verses, I don't need fame, no one to know my name. At the end of the day, Lord, I pray I have a life that's good. Mm-hmm. Like you said, at the end of the day.
At the end of the day.
Right in that chorus, it says, what do you need? It says, two arms around me, heaven to ground me, a family that always calls me home, four wheels to get there, enough love to share, and a sweet, sweet song. At the end of the day, Lord, I pray I have a life that's good. So I do think that absolutely resonates. And it's funny because you look at this wild gold chase, this gold treasure hunt, mm-hmm. and you wouldn't think that maybe there's a little bit of a morality tale in there.
Right.
We don't hit anybody over the head with it. We hit people over the head with other things, but not with that.
Right.
And so I really liked that aspect about it, that there was this arc of redemption. He wasn't just Ward never was just a mustache twirling bad guy that was doing evil just for evil's sake. He was just making bad choices. And one other thing I love about it is if you look at Ward's face in the final moment when he looks at his daughter and he thinks of it, it's the first time you will see true peace in Ward for the whole three seasons, is he finally knows what he's going to do.
Yeah.
And that he's not conflicted by it.
Yeah.
He's not torn up by it. It's like, yeah, yeah, that.
Yeah. And then it came easy. It came easy for him.
In that moment it did. It was like a light of, oh, that's something I can do that I absolutely believe in.
Right. Right. Here's, and you probably get this a whole lot, but you are one of the nicest fucking guys I've ever met in my life.
Need to get out more. I need better friends.
How do you channel the evil bastard that is Ward?
It's funny you say that, because if I went down, you give me a moment, give me a scene, and I will show you how. Look, I had an acting coach once said that what human beings do better than anything is rationalize. Make something you want to do make sense to your moral compass. You can bend it to make it make sense. So I don't know. I mean, the first thing I did was choke out Topper. But people applauded that.
Exactly.
Because Topper's on the front porch talking crap to my daughter. And so, and by the way, that scene wasn't in the show. It was just Topper talking crap to Sarah. And I said to my director, I said, is Ward in the house when this is happening? And he said, yeah. I go, so there's a chance he could hear it? And he goes, yeah. I go, and might it be interesting if he heard it? And he goes, yeah, it would. So I went down and we just did that. I just walked out onto the set while they were doing it and told him to watch his mouth. And he just kept going and said no and kept talking. And so I just put my hands on his throat and lifted him right out the door. But it was that, was that Ward being a bad guy?
No, that was Ward being a father.
Well, that's you rationalizing. That was Ward choking out a 16-year-old. So my point is everything has it. Later, John B is about to destroy my. Did Ward attack Big John? No, Big John started that.
That's true.
And then Big John fell down and hit his head. Now Big John's about to die, and my whole world's going to fall apart. And Ward says, Ward wasn't like, I wonder how I can make him suffer the most. He was like, he's not going to make it. He's dying. And
right.
So what am I going to? So I'm not saying these are right choices. I'm just saying that there's nowhere where I have to play this person who is just a pure monster with no, he's just rationalizing.
He's just rationalizing everything.
Yeah. Yeah.
Huh. That's a fucking perspective right there.
Right? Yeah.
That makes me understand Ward more now.
Well, it makes me understand other people more. You see somebody that does something and nobody, very few. Look, it takes a real psychopath to go, I'm the bad guy. I'm going to be a bad guy.
Right.
People go, I'm going to do this thing that some people might think is bad, but I'm going to do it for good reasons. They don't understand. I kept feeling that constantly. Like when Ward's on the boat and John B. finds out that he knew everything and he goes, we're going back. I'm telling everybody. And Ward just tried to split the money with him.
Right.
Dude, I can set you up. I can help you with everything. Ward wasn't like, let me get him on a boat and kill him. That was never the intention. So
will there be any kind of appearances in season four of you? Like in a dream?
I have no idea. All I knew was we've already played the card that Ward wasn't really dead.
Exactly.
You played it twice. We did.
Did you play it twice?
I don't think so.
No, you played it once. Yeah.
We just played it once. But we're not playing that card again.
Right.
So whether somebody has a memory or.
That's what, yeah.
I have no idea. Yeah. We did that on Nashville when Raina came back.
Yeah.
In a dream sequence. It was sort of more of a daydream sequence where you're just sitting down. And so there's a million ways, and our writers are extremely creative. Believe me, it was hard to walk away from a show with people I love that much and that's doing that well, for sure.
Right.
But I have to tell you, it made me feel better that I knew it was a good ending for the character.
Right.
And you mostly just want to end well, you know.
Wow. Good Lord. Had me chipping at my nails the entire damn time.
Ah.
Good Lord.
You made it. That's our job. That's what we're trying to do. If it was too comfortable, we wouldn't be doing it right.
I had other friends telling me, like, you know, because I took my time. I'm the person who binges through the shows. Mm-hmm. Like, and I don't like
doing it. You do a slow binge?
I do a slow binge. And I don't like doing it. I don't like them when they release weekly. I don't like that shit.
That's too long.
Like,
what's your perfect groove? Like, how often of an episode?
I might do two episodes a night.
All right, but you ain't gonna go four or five.
I'm not. No.
Yeah. My wife, we do both. Sometimes we're cool and calm, we do that. But man, if you fall in love with it, you'll look at each other and go, one more, all right, one more. So yeah. We know people that watched it one day for sure.
Really?
Oh yeah, they just went through Outer Banks. Yeah.
Jesus Christ. Here's the thing is that I was totally against it. Season one. Mm-hmm. I was totally against it. I'm like, I'm not watching this. Like, no. Cause from the picture, you're like, oh, this is nothing that I'm going to be interested in. I'm like, no. Then I started working for Stormy Warren, mm-hmm. and he was talking about it. And I got hooked immediately. The first episode, I'm like, shit. And then I ended up watching the first season in the first week. I took the whole weekend and watched the first season.
There you go.
So I've been hooked ever since. So let's get personal here. Let's talk personal. You're from Pennsylvania. You're from Pittsburgh.
Yes, sir.
I'm from Philly.
Born there. Yeah. Uh-oh. And we've talked about this before. Yeah. You've had more recent success. We've had more extensive
exactly.
success.
Exactly.
Football wise. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So paint the picture of Charles Esten as a kid.
Well, I think a big part of it is that when I was in Pittsburgh, I guess I was about to go in third grade when my parents divorced. Mm-hmm. So we left there and went to Northern Virginia, right outside of Washington, D.C. But I was always going back and forth. So Pittsburgh is in my blood. And a whole lot of that was actually the Steeler team. My father, his business partner was the center for their first Super Bowl Steelers, Ray Mansfield. And so as a young kid, I was in that locker room with Terry Bradshaw, Lynn Swann, and Joe Green, and all those greats, Franco Harris, God rest his soul. So I only say that to say that that was a large part of my identity, because when we moved to D.C., I didn't have much but my terrible towel and an attitude because the Steelers were winning Super Bowls. But also a lot of that, when you grow up in a house that's got a lot of tension and maybe, fights and things like that. I think I grew up trying to be an entertainer, trying to make mm-hmm. everything better, trying mm-hmm. to make people laugh, make them smile. And I do think that's a through line that has stayed with me. And then later when I moved on to the next city, now you're just trying to make them like you because
right.
they all know each other. They've known each other. They've all grown up together. Who's this new guy? I'm like, well, I'm the new guy that can do this.
Right.
You know, so there was a lot of that. And I think those two things, that combination of wanting to make people laugh or feel better and wanting to show off a little bit, meant that early on, I was sort of aiming for some type of show business, whether it was comedy and making them laugh, or I felt I loved, I knew the million ways that music made me feel. So as I started to write it and I could see people go, "Ooh, that's a good song," or something like that. Even as a young kid, I was like, "Oh yeah." So, you know, it became about not just making them laugh, but making them cry maybe, or make, and then later you get to become an actor, make them afraid of Ward or things like that. So it's mostly just a whole lot of, you know, what sums it up is always just sort of like making people feel something.
Right.
Yeah. That's the through line.
Wow. So whose line is it anyway? Mm-hmm. I went back and I watched some episodes. you were fucking hilarious. Cause I watched one of the episodes. I watched the episode with, cause I saw it come up on my Instagram, but I watched the episode with Robin Williams.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
And, first of all, Robin Williams was one of the greatest of all times as far as improv comedy.
Yeah. You know.
How was your experience on Who Lines Is It Anyway? And how does that translate in your life now? Like, how does improv resonate in your life right now?
It's funny because Whose Line was a journey for me because I got on it when I was very, very young. It was in the early 90s. I was in London playing Buddy Holly when the British version was auditioning for new people to be on it. And at that time, I hadn't even heard of it. It wasn't on in the United States. It wouldn't be for a number of years even before it was on Comedy Central, the British version. Mm-hmm. Then, of course, it came over and was the American version. So I had, when I went out to L.A. in the very end of the 80s, very tail end of the 80s, I tried a little bit of stand-up, and it was all right. I just didn't like the solitary nature of it. I liked sketch comedy, and I liked improv. I liked doing scenes with other people. Mm-hmm. So I joined a place called The Groundlings, and when I say joined, I was taking classes there. I never got as far as actually getting into The Groundlings, which was the goal, before I got this job that took me to London. So now I've had a little bit of experience, but I've never done any paid improv anywhere on a stage for anybody. And I get this audition, and that looseness of youth where you just don't care, sort of the balls of youth, like, fine, right, let's try it. Man, I could go for it. And I just really loved it. I loved the, I mean, as the guy who was always the class clown, always the quick wit and the one to say the punchline first, to get to the joke first, to be around these other guys that were just so white hot, fast and funny. It was thrilling. It was intimidating, and it was a real joy. So I started doing that, and this was before I really had an acting career to speak of. So I noticed that later, as I started doing acting, I sometimes realized that my acting could be more improvisational. I thought I need to be more available in the moment to what is actually going on than some preconceived notion I had of the scene. Uh-huh. And why can't I do that? Well, it's easy. One of the reasons is because there are lines. And so in improv, there's no lines. So
right.
You can't. There's no path you can walk. There's people that try to keep the scene going a certain way, but not when you're with Ryan Stiles or Colin Mochrie or, you know, Greg Proops or any of these guys or Wayne Brady. They're going to make it go where they want in that moment, and then you make it go. It's a teamwork thing. So once I realized that, I tried to incorporate it more in my acting and know all the lines, but have no idea how I was going to say them. And I was only going to say them based on how I was responding to what was actually happening. And then also, I think there's life lessons to be learned from it, that you can try to predict and plan everything, but in the moment, you just have to say yes, and you just have to take what life offers you and be improvisational and bend to it in the moment, instead of fighting things that are, instead of fighting reality, find the best way to adapt to that new reality and make it work for you. So I've had a lot of time to think about it, that improvisational spirit in the heart of that. It's super valuable in life and in work.
Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of crazy. Like, I mean, like you said, you have to go with the flow. You have to go with the moment, you know, take it where you want to take it. And you're right. That's how it is in life. When you you go through some shit, or you just make a decision. It can be the tiniest decision, but it's always in the moment that you have to take in and do.
It's funny because people always are like, "Oh, I don't know how you do that." People that are so intimidated and afraid of improv. And then I go, "You've never once been with all your friends and one of your friends says something funny and you never thought to yourself, I need to say something funny. What should I say? What do I say now?" You don't do that. You just say it. You just say the thing. The difference is you're not judging it. If I put four TV cameras on you and four funny guys all around you and you're all dressed up and you're waiting. Now you're going, I have to say the funniest thing that's ever been said, instead of just being loose and going with it. I mean, Buzz knows every one of those happy hours. That's pure improv.
Yeah.
Because you have no idea what the drunk lady from Minneapolis is going to say. And you got to go with it. If you kept trying to go down the path he wanted to go down, as opposed to just going, oh, I guess we're going here.
Yeah.
That's where the sweet stuff is. That's where the gold is, so to speak.
Yeah. I mean, it really is. It really is. So let's move forward to here talking about you moving here to Nashville. Mm-hmm. Listen, I love the show Nashville. It's a love-hate relationship, though, because you guys are the reason why Nashville is as big as and popular it is.
Well, the awesomeness of Nashville is why that is. We just turned a camera lens on it and showed people what it was. So, yeah. Well, you can hate me for the traffic, but you better love me for all the good food.
Exactly.
I heard people say you couldn't find a good restaurant for 10 years before I got here. Not that they all came when we did, but that there was a time where you had to look, you know, high and mighty for anything. No, and now they're everywhere.
No, there was. Because I got here in 2010. You guys hadn't started. You probably started filming, but
we started in 12.
You started in 12. So I had 2 years of regular
pre-Nashville.
Mm-hmm. 2 years pre-Nashville.
I'll say something else too. That flooding in 2010, I think, had a lot to do with the rebuilding and the renaissance of Nashville.
Yes.
When they decided, well, there's a lot of things that have been destroyed, so let's build up and build back better, so to speak.
Especially a lot of the stuff that not on Broadway, because Broadway was mainly flooded.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then the Opry. I went to the Grand Ole Opry the week before it flooded.
So you've seen the difference between what it was and what it is.
Yeah.
And nobody would wish that, you know, that tragedy or that disaster on any city ever. But that you want to talk about what I'm talking about improvising.
Yeah.
The city said, all right, this is a thing that's happened. We can't make it not happen. So how will we adjust to them? What will we do? And you get something better than you started with even.
Yeah. And it's been great to see the growth that this city has done. I still blame Nashville. I blame Nashville all the fucking way. And I don't mean,
Music Row Happy Hour beaming out all over the world on Sirius XM. You don't think that brings people to Broadway? You don't think that causes traffic? Come on now.
Listen. All seriousness, I do love the show. I love the show from the beginning. Is there any similarities between Deacon and Ward?
Oh, yeah. First of all, I mean, because I'm the hub of the wheel and they're the spokes, there almost has to be. I'm the clay that they're both.
Right.
In, me in the writing. Yeah, I can name a handful. The love of family.
Yeah.
Love, you know, I mean, love your daughter. I mean, Deacon loved his, not only his actual daughter, Maddie, but his adopted daughter. Daphne as well. That kind of thing. I think they both have a lightness. They can both be affable and fun when they need to be, but then they both have a darkness. Deacon, people forget. People, Deacon got a little domesticated down the end when he was raising the girls on his own. But the first couple seasons, you know, Deacon would break a man's ass.
Deacon has some demons.
Yeah, absolutely. I would, you know, there was a guy that was touching Scarlett, my niece. Scarlett was giving her a hard time, and I practically threw him through a wall.
Yep.
I was going through a real... So anyway, Deacon could have his dark side as well. Deacon, the difference is, I mean, there's that phrase there, but for the grace of God, go I. Mm-hmm. It was the grace of God. It was the AA programs and the leaning on a higher power and asking for forgiveness from people and trying to get better. Ward, because he was able to hide it all so well from the public, he was able to be out there and get this, you know, award at the country club.
Right.
And everybody saw him as this thing. And so he was trying to maintain a facade that he had to give everything and do everything to maintain. Deacon let the facade down. He just hit his rock bottom. Deacon did sooner than Ward. And Ward didn't have long after his. So they're different, but it's all in there.
It's all in there. So we talk about Nashville. We talk about you moving to Nashville, but let's talk about your music, because we didn't know that you had it in you until you started singing in Nashville. Mm-hmm. and playing that and playing Deacon and playing that character. I just read, and I didn't know this, that you release the most consecutive songs a whole year.
Yeah, yeah.
A whole year. First of all, that's utterly ridiculous.
Right? It's 54 songs in 54 weeks. And you're right, it is. By the way, it's a world record.
It's a world record.
The reason it is a world record is because it's ridiculous.
Yeah.
Nobody, who would want to do this?
Exactly. And that's what I mean. I don't mean ridiculous by bass. So you want to listen and I'm not bashing them. No. I mean ridiculous by, like, that's a lot of fucking work.
Yeah.
To do. One, it's exhausting going in and record a whole album, but let alone
write and record. And by the way, every single one of those needed its own artwork.
Yeah.
And we had nobody doing that. That was my wife and I. We would bring somebody in if we needed a little help on something to make it a little bit better. But I could not have done it with her. I could not have done it without my friend Steve Mandel, who produced a good segment of them in the band Six Wire, who I met on the show. They were Raina's band.
Yes.
And then they became my band and they're unbelievable. But mostly if it tells you anything, it has to plant a flag in the ground of how much I love music and making music.
Yeah.
So you called it work. And it's funny. I go, oh, yeah, I guess it was work. But it never struck me as work.
Right.
It was just something I enjoyed so much. By the time I got to Music City, I was 46 and I felt so far behind it. I felt like, God, I should have come here years ago. So I'm just going to make the most of it and just go. And so I sort of made this promise on social media that I was going to put out one a week. And once you do that, then people are holding you accountable. That's a deadline hack, by the way. I'm telling anybody out there that if you're stalled in something, if you got paralysis of analysis, if you're trying to make the perfect version of this, and so therefore you're not doing any version of this, go somewhere and plant that flag and tell the world that by this date, this will have happened. Mm-hmm. So you're either forced to do it or be a liar out in public. And what that does is it forces you to do it. And that really helped me and that really blessed me. And I've relied on that ever since. Sort of speak it out, say this is going to happen, and then do your best to, you know, follow up and make it happen.
Wow. That's legitimately, you're speaking to me right now. There's some
you
shit.
Have things you want to do.
There's some shit that I want to do.
And you've got them, you've figured them out.
Yeah.
You're just not moving.
Yeah.
So, I mean, this is your, you know, this is one place to do it. Come in here next week or whatever your next, next one of these is and say, hey, I want to lay down some lines in the sand for those of you that follow me. And I'm going to give you a date. And this is when this will happen. And then watch your creativity explode.
Because you're under pressure.
I saw somewhere, somebody said, I forget who said it. I wish I did. I wish I could remember it. It said a fully written bad screenplay is far better
than
a completely unwritten great screenplay.
Wow.
Don't do that.
Yeah.
By do that, I mean, do nothing.
Yeah.
Do something. When my daughter was starting off as a songwriter, she wrote an amazing first song. Mm-hmm. And I think that shut her down a little bit, like, because how do you follow it?
Right.
What if it's not as good? What if people... So I would say to her, I want you to do me a favor. And I think I bribed her. I said, I'll give you like $25 if you go write the worst song in the world. Go write the worst song. And she's like, what? And number one, I know she's not going to write. She could if she tried.
Right.
But whatever it is, good or bad, I was detaching her from the results so that it's the process that matters. It's the doing. So what? You go and wrote the fourth worst song. It's not the worst, but it's pretty bad.
Right.
Now go write another one. Along the way, you're going to get better at it and the things will work out more. So whatever that thing is that you're trying to make so perfect in your brain and it's so holy and sacred to you that you dare not do it. Yeah. You got to let that go. Go make some junk and then go make more junk. And then slowly but surely, without even noticing it, it won't be junk anymore. It'll start to get some quality to it.
Good Lord. Charles Esten is also a motivational speaker here.
Old Tony Robbins.
Old Tony Robbins over here. Good Lord. So let's talk about this because we're talking about your music now, and you just released a single called One Good Move.
Yes, sir.
I love that fucking song.
Ah, thank you,
bro. I do. What was the process of writing that song? What was the inspiration behind that song?
I generally come to songs with a bunch of pieces, like a title or some lyrics or on my phone, a little musical.
Right.
part of that. This one did not happen like that. This one, this is another thing. Sometimes go out of your comfort zone. My friend Twinnie, great UK artist, a young woman, so talented. And she put together this writing retreat, invited a whole bunch of her friends, 20, some or more. And then we group people up and in the morning, then have lunch, then group another group up in the afternoon. And that would be one day. Mm-hmm. She invited me. And I remember saying yes, because I just love writing and I love her. She's awesome. And I knew she'd have some great friends. I remember the morning of that. I'm set to go out in the middle of nowhere in the country. Mm-hmm. Other than 20, I don't believe I'll know anybody there.
Right.
I'm feeling a little out of my comfort zone. I'm probably older by far than most of them. And I can remember thinking, I don't know if I'm going to go to this. I could probably easily call up and get out of this. But I'm old enough to know that all the times I've ever felt that and went, something good came of it. Mm-hmm. So I said, I'm feeling that feeling again. That to me starts smelling like the gold.
Wow.
Like it's called resistance. It's like that thing, I don't know if I want to do this. Well, as soon as you hear that, you go, okay, then I definitely need to do that.
Right.
So I went and I loved the first song we wrote. And then I was at lunch and I was just talking to these young female songwriters I was going to write with, Elise Hayes, Zarni DeVette, and Sam Backhoff. And I was talking about being young and how I was sort of a pretty much of an idiot when I was a young guy. Uh-huh. And I said, you know what, except for one thing, somehow that moron found the love of his life. And not only that, but was able to hang on to her, even through all his stupidity, he made that. She's my one good move. And they went, well, we're writing that. And so I didn't show up with a title in my head. It was just talking with them, which is always a great way to write a song. You're just sharing things back and forth, with sharing your heart with people. And we went into the writing room and Zarni sat down at the piano, started playing a little piano riff that is still on it. She recorded, she did the demo. She cut the demo on me. Zarni did. So she played the piano part.
Right.
I love that piano part on that demo so much that we kept that for this recording that's going to be on my album. And that's the single you hear. That's Zarni starting off playing that riff, that little piano riff that she started on. And I instantly knew the direction of this song. She was my one good move. And what it is what I feel sometimes. I wake up in the morning, sun's coming through the window. I'm a blessed guy. And I think, this didn't have to happen. So I think, how did I get here? It's all too good. Wow. The story isn't ending like I thought it would.
Right.
Sun through the window. You're all I see. I'm 500,000 miles from where I used to be. Yeah, you remember me. When there was trouble to get into, I was getting into it. When there's something that I shouldn't do, you know I would do it. I was young. I was dumb. I was always on the run. I messed it up all but once. Because when I look at you, I see my one good move. So that just, it's funny on retrospect, things just, you know, we struggled and we fought. We made that song come out in a couple of hours, but it didn't feel that hard if I'm being honest.
Right.
Yeah.
Wow.
And I love that these, as I said, these were young women. So these, I wasn't sitting around with a bunch of guys that had been married for decades.
Right.
And we're all writing from the same place.
Right.
But every one of these young women contributed mightily to this song. And that just shows a real talent that they put themselves in another's boots. And they wrote a song that was not their life experience, but that they have enough creativity and imagination and skill and talent to add to all along the way. So,
right.
Yeah, it was great.
That's insane. Holy shit. It's amazing how a common conversation can just spark.
Oh, that's the good stuff. That's when it's like
this is gold. Sometimes it's great going in, but other times it's like it's still.
Well, that's Nashville to a T. You'll be in any place, and like you could be at a charity event and somebody's giving a speech, or maybe you're just at a restaurant and a big table of people and somebody says something.
Right.
Always check out the writers in that moment, and you'll see them looking at each other. An eyebrow will go up, or a phone will come out.
Yeah.
Or this phrase is a big one in Nashville. We need to write that one.
Yeah.
So like if somebody says something like, you know, some phrase like, oh, she's my one good move. Yeah, we need to write that
one. We need to write that one.
Yeah.
Good Lord. Well, my friend, my buddy, this has been great. This has been fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, it's very unusual without a big drunken crowd, but I've enjoyed it.
I know. It's like, I mean, normally we just have someone scream or something, you know?
We can add that in post, all right?
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Exactly. This has been, I want to thank you so much for coming out today.
Oh, thank you,
bro. Seriously. This has been another episode of Spunkshots and Podcasts. And we have here the one, the only, Mr. Charles Esten. Thank you so much, buddy.
Listening to the smoking section.